I just want to make sure that everything is...
Sure.
Oh, I know what I don't.
Be sent. Just make sure. I think that's working all right.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's fine.
Let me begin then by indicating that today is December 13th, 1994, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Richard Heckert in his office at the DuPont Building in Wilmington. Dr. Heckert, I know you were born in Oxford, Ohio on January 13th, 1924, and your father was a professor at Miami University. Could you tell me a little more about your father and mother and some of your family background?
Well, Dad was an immigrant. He came, he was born in 1872, came to the U.S. in 1886 when he was 14, and came alone, which always sort of amazed me. He had an uncle over here that was supposed to help him get started and, I guess, look after him until he was old enough to take care of himself. Somehow that relationship didn't work out very well, so Dad and his uncle parted company. And my father went to Minneapolis, or Minnesota rather, where they spoke a lot of German in those days. Got a job as a farmhand on a German family's farm, and worked there for a number of years, married the farmer's daughter, my mother. For whatever reason, Dad had a consuming interest in education, and he finished high school in the U.S., went to college, finished his four-year degree in college, and then went to graduate school in Columbia and got a Ph.D. in education from Columbia, which always impressed me and somewhat amazed me that this immigrant kid would have that much interest in education and that much drive to get it. So he was a very interesting person in his own right. He liked science. I rummaged through our attic one time and found some biology slides that he'd prepared for a course in biology, apparently. He never talked much about that interest, but he clearly had it and maintained it all his life. So, mother was a farmer's daughter, and Dad met her at an early age, and their marriage was a very constructive and wonderful thing. They celebrated their 50th anniversary with, I guess, a 1952, or maybe a little before then, can't recall exactly, and Dad died a year or two later. But that's a thumbnail sketch. He taught in a couple of places, but wound up at Miami and spent most of his time as director of the teacher training school, McGuffey, and a professor of philosophy of education in Miami.
You are the youngest of four.
Yes.
I recall, and the other three, it seems, are quite a bit older than
quite a bit. I was a surprise, and whether it was a good one or not remains to be determined, I guess.
We'll come back to your older brother in a moment, but what was it like growing up in Oxford at that time?
Well, Oxford was a small town, and Miami at that time was a relatively small university, perhaps 3,000 students when I attended, and somewhat less as I grew up. It had all the advantages of a small town. If you got into mischief, by the time you got home for lunch, your mother knew about it. So retribution was quick, and it was a wonderful place to grow up. Oxford's a very lovely little town, and was then, and still is, a nice location. The university environment was certainly conducive to learning, and just a wonderful place to spend your youth. I feel very fortunate to have been raised in that setting compared to some that kids suffer today.
I understand you played football for Weave Eubanks in high school, which was
that's true. Intriguing. Weave was our high school coach for the years that I was in school there, and a wonderful man, obviously a good coach, as his later career demonstrated, but More than that, he was a friend of every kid that he worked with, and he made a lot of them better than they were when he got them. He just had a way of straightening kids out that were on the wrong path. So he was a developer of good young people as well as a pretty good coach. Still alive, incidentally, and still lives in Oxford.
Really? I didn't realize that. Were there any other extracurricular activities? Sports? Was the sports an interest?
Well, I've played everything and liked everything. I loved to hunt and fish, still do. My dad, being a college professor, did have time in the summer, and he took us camping year after year for a month or so. And we lived in a tent in the woods. A great way to experience the joys of nature. He never hunted much, but he didn't have any objection to my hunting. And so I had a shotgun early in my life, and we've used it ever since.
What kind of interests, academic interests, were you developing in high school?
I suppose because of my brother's love of science and math, I sort of got steered in that direction. But I really liked the physical sciences and math early in life, and felt challenged by them and enjoyed them. So thanks to some very good teachers at the grade school and high school level, it was easy to genuinely enjoy those subjects and to want a career in them.
Did you interact much with your brother? He was, what, almost 20 years old?
No, all my siblings were out of the nest before I have any recollection of them. My sister and brother lived nearby. My younger brother lived nearby for a few years, so I saw them fairly often. But Wendy, we call him Winfield, lived here on the East Coast, and we saw him a couple of weeks a year on vacation. That was it. So I didn't have any extensive contact with him, but when we were together, he was always pushing a career in chemistry, and I thank him for that.
And he was at DuPont.
He was at DuPont. He came, I think, to this company in 1928, survived the Depression, did very well personally, and thoroughly enjoyed his work.
Was it preordained you would go to Miami University?
It was cheap and it was convenient. I think my college education probably cost my dad $400 or $500, and that was just the right price for those days. But it was also a good school. I have no regrets about that.
What was the, let's see, you started there probably, what, 1940?
41.
41.
Fall of 41.
Just before Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Did that have any influence on your college?
Yes, it kind of a sad experience to go through school in that environment. I was lucky enough to get deferred until I finished, which was certainly a good fortune. But the male population dwindled very rapidly, and in the last couple of years, I did it in 3 years, because of the urgency to get out if I could with a degree. And the last year and a half wasn't nearly as normal and as much fun as it would have been otherwise, but I got it done, and that was very helpful. I actually graduated when I had been in the Army for a few weeks.
What were some of your experiences there in terms of the chemistry? What kind of courses were they offering? What was the faculty like?
Faculty was very good, both in math, physics, and chemistry, all three. I was blessed with excellent teachers, excellent professors. In chemistry, can't remember the names of all of them. The inorganic courses were the first ones, and then organic chemistry, and Carl Webb I remember very well. He was a kind of a dour old gentleman. He loved chemistry, and I think he enjoyed the fact that it was a little difficult, Both he and his subject matter were occasionally intimidating, but he was a very warm person underneath, and he and I became very, very good friends. Analytical, I took, and physical chemistry, so those were just the four principal courses, and some others that were related. All well taught, and all thoroughly enjoyable, at least I thought so. Math, there was a friend of mine, a father of a friend of mine, close friend, that was an excellent math teacher, and I had a course from him which was absolutely marvelous, calculus. And the other teachers I had were also fine, stimulating, and friendly and helpful. Physics, my next door neighbor taught physics. So in that environment, you know, you really do know the faculty pretty well if you're a faculty kid, and there is no excuse for not doing your best. So for the most part, it went well.
We just said the war, so there weren't, the male population was dwindling, but were there many chem majors?
By the time I graduated, there were a half a dozen left. Many of them came back and finished later on, but their ranks were decimated.
How did you manage to get deferments?
I have no idea, but I'm grateful. I had obviously a good grade average, and for whatever reason, because I guess I was taking the right courses, and I got two or three in a row, which gave me just enough time to finish my work, and then I was drafted and spent a little time in the infantry, but most of it at Oak Ridge, which was a great experience.
I was going to ask you how, well, when you were drafted, where did you go first?
Texas, Camp Fannin.
Okay.
Infantry Replacement Training Corps, which means that from the time you're inducted to the time you're in the trench, it's about 13 weeks. But at the 10th week, I was very lucky. Oak Ridge ran out of chemists, and they came looking. Half a dozen of us came from Camp Fannin to Oak Ridge. And interestingly, three of those later wound up with the pond. Hmm. Dave Barnes and Larkin Wires and myself.
And what were you asked to do at Oak Ridge?
Well, I started out in a sort of a tech service group, a plant, a methods group, I guess you'd call it, trying to improve the process by studying the practices, methods used, and make suggested changes to make things better. I didn't like that work very much. I was much more of an activist than that. And later on, not too many weeks after I got there, one of the process sections needed an additional member in supervision. I was brought there initially in a technical capacity, and then actually in line management of that function. That was a very important turning point in my life. I really liked that work. I liked the hands-on process aspect of it. Of course, it was new and exciting, and changes were coming very fast because that work had never been piloted. The plant was the pilot plant, and so we were learning as we did our work. And it was just a marvelous experience and convinced me that maybe I should not become a teacher. Maybe I ought to really get into business and work in something other than just research. So that's where the slight derailment in career thoughts occurred. I probably would have been a teacher had it not been for that. At least I was headed in that direction, professor. I would have gone on to graduate school, I'm sure of that, but I probably would have looked at the academic work very favorably.
Who were you working for, and in what specific group were you working?
I was working with the Y-12 division in what we called salvage, which was an operation designed to recover as much of the enriched material as they could. And in that process, there were two enrichments. The first, from ordinary uranium deposits to an enriched U-235 material. That had to be recycled one more time to make it weapons-grade material. Well, after the first treatment, you had a fortune invested in every ounce, not very much of it to work with, and so salvage was very important to make sure that none of it was lost that could possibly be recovered. So we did everything from clean old pieces of equipment to burn clothing and extract uranium from the residues. We tried to get everything that got out of the system back into the system that we possibly could. So we had a variety of chemical unit operations, all kinds of countercurrent extraction materials, centrifuges and filters and all the digestion tanks and all the rest that a normal chemical plant has. And it was just fun. It was the only course in chemical engineering I ever had, but it was good. and the price was right. So that's what I did. As I say, initially I was kind of a technical assistance person, but I got into line management and ran a unit of that particular division for a few months.
Were you, how were you briefed about what the purpose of all of this was?
Well, none of us knew exactly how it was going to be used, but we knew we were working with uranium. We knew we were working with U-235 specifically. The only two logical things that could be done with that material was, number one, to make a bomb out of it. That was everybody's bet. But it was not out of the question that the radioactivity could be a basis for some kind of weapon. And so that couldn't be totally ruled out, but those of us that thought about it, I think most of us assumed it would be an explosive. We were never told that. We were only told what we were doing, what the goal of the plant was, which was to recover U-235 from the mix with 238.
What were the safety considerations like?
I don't think we were nearly as concerned about radiation as people are today. We worked very hard to be sure we didn't exceed the critical mass. You know, we didn't want too much material stored in one place. So that safety aspect was given a great deal of attention. I never worked with the material that was processed twice, that is the purest 235 that we made. I don't know exactly what precautions were taken with that, but I'm sure critical mass was one thing it was paid a great deal of attention to. But the other handling procedures I'm not familiar with. We dealt with the salt and the fluoride and the oxide of uranium, and had the normal chemical process safety concerns and the normal safety problems. But it was pretty much don't get it on you, don't put too much in one corner, and be careful when things are under pressure or hot, you know, that sort of thing. But I have to say we were not anywhere near as concerned about radiation per se as people are today, and most of us have not suffered from it, but I suppose history's still working on that.
When the bomb was dropped in 45, what effect did that have? What was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was very positive, and it's never changed. There are detractors from the program, and I'm constantly told by people who were yet unborn that it wasn't necessary, but having lived through that period, I think it saved a very, very large number of lives on both sides. And I think a good deal of the world stability that existed in the next 50 years was due to the threat of this terrible material. So I don't think there is such a thing as a humane war. I think that's a non sequitur if there ever was one. Oxymoron or whatever, however you want to categorize it. And so, it's a terrible weapon, but it did bring an end to that war much more quickly than would otherwise have happened. And the subsequent peaceful uses of atomic energy really are very good. Some countries have done it better than we in the U.S. France has done superbly with generating power from uranium. We got all bogged down and distracted by some things that really weren't all that important, and we deprived ourselves of a source of energy that is really very, very benign environmentally. It's really a very nice, clean stuff if you do it right. And we still fuss about not being able to treat used material satisfactorily or store it satisfactorily when the French have been doing it for, 30 or 40 years and very efficiently. And we just have no excuse for the way that we've managed our affairs nationally. Too bad. But no regrets. At the time, all of us who worked on the project felt very good that we hadn't just dodged the less attractive aspects of the war, but we had in fact made a contribution to bring the whole darn thing to a close.
Now, you were still in the service for another year after that.
Yes.
About right. What did you... you stay in that same group?
Yes. And came reasonably close to spending another year or two there as a civilian. They made a very attractive offer, which I found tempting. Even the service tried a little seduction. They said, I played softball in those days, and I was a halfway decent softball player. And in retrospect, it's really very, very funny, but my unit commander or somebody like that came to me and said, you know, if you'd be willing to stay on to the end of the softball season, life would be pretty good around here. I thanked him very much. Told him I thought maybe I'd better get on with it. So it was a funny little exchange, but I guess it would have convenienced them if they hadn't lost all their troops quite as fast as they were leaving. But I thanked them profusely and moved on.
You went to Illinois then. How did you select Illinois?
Oh, that was easy. The staff at Miami were very positive on Illinois, and my brother Wendy, even though he was an Ohio State graduate, said that if you like organic chemistry, that's the place to go. And I don't think there was much doubt about that after the war.
Your interest in organic development as an undergraduate, is that correct?
Yes.
What was it about organic that you said you loved the math, but that physical didn't have the...
Yeah. Well, I think my perception probably gained through my older brother was that that's where it was. You know, that's the basis of all the polymer work that DuPont was doing. Didn't take a genius to figure out that organic chemistry was the chemistry of life. And the more we learn about it, the more we're going to be able to regulate those functions that are so important to us. You could see it happening. We were learning so fast, and you knew it was going to be exponential. And so it looked like a field that would just plain be fun. And you could see it at the graduate school level merging with biochemistry and all the other branches that dealt more directly with life science. And you just knew eventually that we'd understand what was going on at the molecular level, and you and I have lived to see that, which is pretty darn impressive and fascinating. So it was easy to fall in love with that.
Did you, you went there in 46, got your master's in 47, your PhD in 49. Roger Adams, Carl Marvel, of course, are two names that come to mind right away. Did you interact with them in any sense?
Quite a bit. Well, with the whole staff. Harold Snyder was my research professor, and he's a wonderful man, and again, a great developer of people and other parts of the personality and the whole being than just science. Tucson was great. They were all just wonderful people, and not just in the organic section, but in the physical and inorganic section. I just thought that staff was unique in the quality of the people and in the way in which they interacted. They were really very, very close, very supportive of one another, and very helpful to young people that were trying to find their way through.
How did you select Snyder as your mentor?
I liked his mannerisms, his approach to teaching, and his approach to his students very, very much. Any of them would have been fine, but I don't know, just a little body chemistry, I guess. I just sort of liked his approach to life and the way he encouraged young people. So, frankly, it's been so long I can't remember whether there were any other reasons, but the kind of work that he was doing was I don't remember that being a tremendous plus or minus. He was just good at what he did, and he was working in a general way with different kinds of organic chemistry, and I thought I'd be a good fit, and it was a fine relationship.
Did he have a big group?
Pretty large. There were, as I recall, give or take a dozen. That may not be the right number, but he had had seminars in his home for all his research students several times a year, so that the third-year people and the ones that were just coming into the group all met together, and we'd each talk about our research. But in those sessions, in his home, in a very friendly environment, we talk about a lot of things. You know, talk about life much more broadly than just chemistry. So he was a very positive and a very strong influence on a lot of his people. And as a result, they stayed very close to him throughout his life.
Yes, you did. At least you had one paper in JAX with Snyder on sulfanilamides. That was
yes.
Your thesis work?
That was one. I worked on sulfanilamide analogs of fatty acids, unsaturated acids. Chemistry was simple, but those fatty acids don't behave very well in a pod. So it was difficult work. But, perhaps nothing very profound, but all good fun.
During this time, were you in contact with your brother at all? Did you maintain any contact?
Mm-hmm. We always have been good friends, and so there were some communication, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. Grad students don't write lots of letters. At least I didn't.
Because he was at DuPont, was it preordained you were going to come here, or had you thought of other possibilities?
My view was that my brother Don was here too. And my brother-in-law had worked for Remington for a while, so it looked a little incestuous to me. And my initial thinking was that two Heckerts in DuPont was enough. I was glad to go and see them, but I really thought I ought to go someplace else. Experience with Tennessee Eastman was very positive. I thought Eastman and or Tennessee Eastman would be a very good alternative. I interviewed them very seriously with that in mind. I liked 3M. I had their fellowship, and I liked Mallinckrodt. It was a different kind of arrangement. I looked at the oil company. Then I came to see DuPont, I really liked what I saw. Somewhere in the course of that interview, people convinced me that my brother and I would not get in each other's way. And that was a very reasonable thing to say, because he was well up in the organization and I was, 20 years his junior and working in a totally different part of the pond. And it didn't take very long for me to perceive that it probably didn't make any difference. There were six of us. And particularly with the age disparity, I concluded, well, this is not a problem. I like the Wilmington area. I like the work. So I changed my mind rather completely in the interview process. I really had not intended to come at the pond.
Who did you interview with? Who did you talk to?
Well, Ted Cairns must have been one. I talked with several people, I'm sure. But I must say, I don't remember everybody I met on that day. It's been a long time. I suspect that I know every one of them, and I've just forgotten that they were a part of that particular exercise. But I knew that Central Research Group very well, and still do. At least the ones that were were peers. And they were a great group.
Did they tell you during the interview where you would be going or what you would be doing?
Well, I applied at I was being interviewed by Central Research, so that was the target, and that would be the first assignment. But I was pretty candid in that interview, and I told them I did not think I would be a career scientist. So I had too much fun doing things that are related to chemistry, but are not just chemistry. And the day may come when I want to get off into manufacturing or marketing or something else. And you know, if that's a strike against me, you better know it now, because that's my predisposition. And that did not seem to be a problem. I loved the research. 5 years that I did it, really enjoyed it. But I knew all along that, it wasn't going to be forever, and I'd do something else.
Was it your Oak Ridge experience that led you to think that way?
Very largely.
The work you did in those first 5 years was pretty fundamental chemistry.
Yes.
TCNE work.
Yes. Great fun. You know, TCNE reacts with everything.
You can see that in the papers. There's page after page of new compounds that are listed.
The only thing it didn't do was make money. There were lots of jokes about that, and I told Cairns I never made him any money, but I cost him more than almost anybody else that came along.
Where did the idea come for the TCNE work?
Well, the original thought was that being an analog of tetrafluoroethylene, and there's some similarities between fluoro and cyano groups in some respects that might make a very interesting polymer. It doesn't. At least we never could. We could get gunk out of it and maybe two or three units hooked up some strange way, but we could never make a linear polymer out of TCNE. I don't think anybody else ever has or will. But in the course of working with it, of course, we discovered that it reacted in a Diels-Alder sense with everything that had a diene. It reacted with active aromatic compounds, amines and phenols and things like that, in a variety of ways. It made brilliant colors with some of the aromatic materials, and it was just incredibly interesting. And did many, many different things, and did them very quickly and very easily. So it was an organic chemist's dream. As I say, the only thing it didn't do was make money.
What were the So your interest turned to dyes as opposed to...
Turned to dyes. We saw the molecules were relatively small and substantive to polyester and polyamide. Polyesters were very brilliant. Polyamides were a little bit dull because I guess the interaction between the dyes and the polymer chain had some effect in any way. Not chemical, but just physical. But the colors were incredibly sharp and bright. The spectrum was very simple. and its orphan was strong and limited to a short range, so they were very bright colors. And not much trash in the rest of the visible spectrum. So we tried again. You could really produce incredible colors, but they were not wash fast and they were not light fast, and those are two fairly fundamental aspects of dyes. Well, that's pretty much the dye story. None of the other compounds appeared to be particularly attractive for any use that we could think of. So after a while, we finally just decided this was great chemistry, but it probably was not going to pan out.
Wasn't there a patent litigation on that molecule? It seemed to me that TCNE was involved in a patent suit. I may be wrong, but...
If there was, I can't recall it.
Okay.
I don't think the... there could have been some derivative that was involved. I can't remember anything of that sort. Which doesn't mean it didn't happen. I just don't recall it.
Was it about the end of that 5-year period when everything died on that? is when you called a halt for the TCNE work?
Well, I think I may have. Can't remember whether that was the last thing I worked on or whether I also had another project or two before I left. But at the end of 5 years, I went to the Sulfane Technical Section in Richmond, Virginia, and began working more closely to manufacturing. I worked in that section a couple of years and then went to the plant as technical superintendent, and then for the next 8 years or so worked in manufacturing, either in a technical or managerial capacity, which I dearly loved. That was fun.
The move to Richmond, was that, did you instigate that move?
Well, I was getting restless, and I don't remember specifically saying it's time to go, but I certainly told my friends that I was interested in getting into an operating department, so-called, and so I suspect they read the handwriting on the wall. This guy is getting restless. And so it happened.
You were in Richmond about 3 years, I think. Or no, longer than that.
A little longer than that.
4 or 5 years.
Yes.
And did this cement your idea that managing a plant or being in that kind of atmosphere was what you really wanted?
At that time, I thought that was exactly what I wanted. My first goal was to become a plant manager, if that would be possible. And that happened pretty quickly. And then after that, I didn't really... Once you get away from hands-on, it didn't make much difference to me what the function was. I didn't feel very comfortable in marketing, but in research and manufacturing, either one, that was fine.
You, of course, were probably interacting with a lot of people who were chemical engineers.
Yes.
You had, as you said, one course in chemical engineering.
Very practical. Yeah, but I've always been a mechanical person. I did my own things around the house, and so that's never bothered me. I'm as comfortable in it as if I knew what I were doing.
Then you went out to Iowa. You were still in the cellophane plants out there.
Yeah, very short stint out there, 9 months.
Again, was it somebody else's bidding that you move out there?
Well, it's a practice of DuPont to move people around, give them experience in different environments, different associations. That was very good for me because Spruance plant was sort of the lead research plant for the cellophane business. The technical section was located there, and a lot of the plant work was experimental. As a consequence, the plant didn't run quite as well as it would have had it just been allowed to settle down and make cellophane. And That began to bother me late in my career there. I guess I should have been happy that I was working in such a research-friendly environment, but I thought we were also supposed to make cellophane and make good cellophane and make a little money. We also had some people in direct line manufacturing that had a technical bent and were inclined to have their own program along with the formal technical program. That bothered me a little bit. So I thought it would be fun to go and work and have an experience in a plant that was regarded as a first-class manufacturing facility, not necessarily a real strong technical organization. So in 9 months, I saw what happens when you really focus on manufacturing and cost, and it was a good part of my training. It was a very different environment, and they're both important. But if you're at some point, you got to settle down and run the plant, and Clinton did that very well.
Then you went to Ohio.
In Mylar.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure that I didn't think it was cellophane.
No, it's Mylar.
Okay.
That plant had just started up and been running a few years, and process was difficult. The learning curve was very steep. And so the first 2 or 3 years there, we had lots of process problems. We had lots of safety problems. And in the 4 years that I was there, we made a great deal of progress on both. Safety was a real challenge, and we turned that around completely with considerable agony, but completely. And the process, we learned a lot about, and by the time I left, it was fun managing that plant. But when I first got there, it was pretty hectic.
When you say you had safety problems, what, was it attitude problems, or was it...
Well, it's always an attitude problem. It was not a fundamental process problem. That is, it wasn't any more hazardous than... most of the other plants we run, but for whatever reason, the group hadn't gotten off to a very good start, and people really weren't thinking safety first.
Okay.
And the first few months that I was managing that plant, we had 2 or 3 major injuries, and that is to say lost time injuries, and although nobody was killed or seriously maimed, that's just unacceptable in the plant. And one of my very good friends from Richmond was then my boss, or at least at a higher level of manufacturing. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, "When your neck gets red enough, that'll stop happening." You know, you could have stabbed me with a knife and hurt me less, but to lay it on the line that I was the guy that had to make the change, it was my fault if we had these problems, did get my attention. And so I talked with small groups. There were 500 or 600 people in the plant, and I talked with groups of 20 or 30 at a time until I'd covered everybody in the plant. And made it very clear that, you know, that was not acceptable, and we were going to stop. And they believed me because it was true. So that was a very difficult experience, but a very important lesson. When the top guy believes in safety, you have a good record. And if he just goes through the motions, that's not enough.
Well, DuPont's always had a, in general, a record of being a leader,
right,
in safety.
Well, that's why I thought I was, you know, I could not believe that I was in any way coming up short on that subject. But the results speak for themselves. Whether it was me or the plant didn't really matter. It was my job to turn it around. And it was a real challenge, and I was pleased. I've been very proud of that group for many, many reasons. But particularly for the change they made in safety, they really stopped having accidents, which is great. They also did a lot of other things very well.
By the time you left, after 4 years, had you worked out the technical problems pretty much?
We've made a lot of progress, as you know, in any process. That's a continuous evolution, and the lines ran well. Still had some quality problems, and I suppose they would say that today. But I no longer had the agony of, when I was playing golf, of seeing black smoke coming from the direction of the plant. So that tells me they weren't burning waste. No, it ran pretty well.
At this particular point, were you thinking more about changing your direction within the company? You said at one point you thought once you got to manufacturing that was going to be it.
Well, I don't think anybody knows where the ceiling is. I realize that may be a Midwestern attitude long since disappeared from the face of the earth, but it was in the late 60s and early 70s that guys with degrees in business and some technical background wanted to be vice president the day they joined the company. That was not the attitude of the people of my generation. You know, we expected to work at whatever we did and did well, and the future would take care of itself. I never had a specific goal of becoming anything other than perhaps the next level or maybe a level beyond that, but I just didn't think that way. And I was always pleased when the opportunities presented themselves, but I think my earlier words are right. I was comfortable in research. I was comfortable in manufacturing. I knew I could run those operations at any level if the opportunity presented itself. But I also worked with a lot of people that I respected very, very much. And when somebody else got the nod, as they did from time to time, that didn't upset me. You know, I didn't want to take my ball and go home. I said, those are good people. Why shouldn't they? So that was my attitude in the whole process, and I never really had difficulty dealing with somebody else getting the selection at some point in time along the way, because I knew these people and they were good. Why shouldn't they?
In 65, you went to be assistant general manager of the film department and then over to plastics in 67. So now you're moving
I'm
into
generalist.
Yes.
Whatever that is.
I was going to ask what that meant to you.
Well, it means that you've got to stop thinking just in terms of one discipline or another, but think about the business. And by then, I was quite prepared for that. I had attended enough marketing sessions because of my research responsibilities so that I was comfortable with marketing people, genuinely liked them, and liked the interaction with customers. I had a little bit of experience with that. Learned a lot about that interface and what's good about it and what can be bad about it. I'm laughing because there was one problem we had in cellophane with a customer who was having difficulty with moisture protection. And we had sent him several test samples, and we didn't seem to be making any progress, and we knew they were different. So finally, this was clear back in the cellophane days, but the plant manager and I went down to the plant and talked with this customer and really in depth about how they were handling the test samples, etc. We finally got hold of the guy that ran the test, and he said, well, when you get a new roll, what do? Take this whole right through the process. He says, well, I go get that roll that we've gotten originally and I retest it. And none of us could believe what he just said. But he meant it. He was not testing the new material. He was testing material, retesting material, which he'd had all along. Well, that's an absolutely absurd thing to have happen. But that sent a very strong message to me. You know, when you're dealing with customers, you really need to know exactly what they're thinking and saying. because what you're hearing may not be what you think you're hearing. And, well, that's a kind of a corny little example, but there were a number of such situations along the way, and I became to appreciate the fact that suppliers and customers have a very special relationship and a very unique opportunity, which they can either screw up or they can work together in such a way they really help one another. And so I developed my own view about marketing and what's important in it. And obviously, that's just a little piece of it, but eventually I became fairly comfortable with that aspect of the business, and then I really didn't care what I did.
Well, later on, you make it very clear to the rest of the people in the company what the customer relationship should be.
Yes, I did.
and the fact that at one point DuPont had the products and said, here they are, and then you turned that attitude around. Were you thinking, was that already developing at this point?
Yes, it was coming along. In the 70s, it was clear that DuPont had to make some dramatic changes, and I would say during those years when Herb and later when Jeff were chairman, I had some pretty strong feelings about how we interface with customers and what was wrong with that relationship. And with the complete support from both Herb and Jeff, I pursued my own agenda in that area. And I think it was helpful.
When you were in the film department and then in plastics, who were you reporting to?
In the film department, I reported to Norm, and up the upper levels now, and Norm Copeland, who eventually became a senior vice president, and then to Walt Simon, who was head of the department. When I moved over into plastics, I was an assistant manager of the department, and I reported to Roy Schuyler. All of these people are wonderful people and very, very different and great teachers and great doers, too. Especially, well, Schuyler is a special case. He was a very interesting guy to be with and very effective and very much a doer. Norm was a little more laid back, but very, very proficient with people and with technology. Walt was a little bit on the philosophical side, but also very thoughtful, and you could learn a lot just listening to him and talk about what the business ought to be. And so each was contributed importantly to my view of the business, but in quite different ways.
I'm quoting now. I don't have the source here, but I could get it if you wanted it. When you were in plastics, it said, as number two man, General Electric took away DuPont's leadership in the profitable and growing automobile plastics business. The setback instilled in Heckert a keener appreciation of marketing, but it did not seem to hinder his career.
I wasn't there long enough to take responsibility for that. Yeah, it bothered us, and there were a lot of lessons in that period that I remember very clearly. One is that the worst thing in the world you can do is be defensive about mature products or maturing products. If something new is coming along and it clearly has a place, you better decide either how you're going to deal with it or how you're going to exploit it, one or the other. It is coming. And I think that was really the message. DuPont had a strong position in fluorocarbons and in polyamides and pretty good one in polyesters. No position in some of the other basics that were clearly going to be important. And elected not to take a position. And we suffered the consequences.
Was that an executive committee decision at that point? Was it made at lower levels?
Pretty hard to pinpoint. There was a strong underlying feeling in the company that we didn't belong in commodity businesses. problem with that is that most businesses become commodities. And if you think you can invent fast enough so you'll never have to live that way, that's fine. But as the world became more and more competitive, which it did, international competition became a daily fact of life. As more and more companies developed the same recipe we did, with strong research programs and good marketing efforts and strong manufacturing, we were in another world. This was quite a change, external change, that we could not ignore. And one of the simple results of that is that commodities may be commodities, but if they're going to be damned important and if they're going to make money, you better not thumb your nose at them. You better figure out how to be a player and be a player on your earnings terms. Make some money at it, but be a player. So we let some things go that probably should have gotten into. Some of the decisions we made were probably right. Polyethylene is one of the greatest things that ever came down the road and never made anybody any real money. So, you know, there are different ways of looking at the same problem, and you do have to be selective. You can't do it all. We missed a couple, but we probably were right in a couple of other instances by staying out.
With something we were saying earlier, that as something matures, you need to be aware of what may be coming down the road.
Right.
And maybe the number of times people thought there was no tomorrow in terms of what the future was going to hold.
Well, those are three very different business problems, and our response was quite different in each case. The dives of business, for whatever reason, we had simply not stayed competitive and not made the investments either in technology or in manufacturing facilities, and it got in trouble at about the time when we were really understanding what international competition means, namely that some countries and some companies don't play by the same business rules that we do. We learned all about subsidies and people that don't really care about as much as we do about returns as they do about market share and things like that. And depending on how what kind of competitors you have in a given business, you can have a variety of different problems. And the dyes business really got to be not to our liking. And we certainly had not stayed abreast of the industry in some respects. So that one was really not a very difficult call. It was time to admit that the way the business was headed, it probably wasn't as important upon as it had been, and we perhaps should let it go. The chlorofluorocarbon thing was, at first, it was just hard to understand, difficult to know whether or not these were real changes, and until we had the science, we were not in a position to make a very intelligent business decision or choice. It took quite a while for that science to to be documented, and I know there's a lot of concern about how long it took DuPont to make the decision it did to discontinue certain things and work hard on alternatives. The fact is that we made that decision 3 days after the information was available. We did not sit on our hands. Neither did we panic when we just weren't quite sure what the science was. So all during that period we'd been working on alternatives. We understood the science of the longevity of these molecules in the stratosphere, and we began working on things that either didn't have any chlorine in them or would come apart much quicker and would not build up and cause difficulties in the stratosphere. That replacement program was expensive, I think very successful. It remains to be seen whether 10, 20 years down the road we'll be happy with the business. I really don't know. But I certainly think I applaud what we've done. We've given the world alternatives and good ones. And we will eventually get over the problem that's up in the stratosphere. I'm not sure that we'll even see the difference here on Earth, but the chemistry will clear up and we'll be happy again, and we'll be have more natural products up there and fewer man-made. So I think our response there was strong and good and appropriate. People can think what they want to about the period it was required to really establish the science, but that is in fact how long it took. Mm-hmm. And once we had the results, we didn't sit around on it. The lead thing, it's really hard to know whether the social trade-offs were really that important. I'm not sure. Lead is a problem in children, but lead got in children largely through paint and not by kids eating out of the gutter. I've never been sure whether that was as important to society as some of the other things that we've dealt with. It may be, and I certainly agree that you can run cars without lead. And we're doing so now, and so that decision is made, and there's no point in agonizing over the exact measurement of the trade-offs. But there was a lot of misinformation in the public arena at the time the decision was made, and lead did do a good job. It made gasoline burn very well. But once you change the engines and the fuel, optimize both, you wind up with a completely workable situation. And if in fact the environmental people that raised the distribution of lead problem as a primary concern, I don't know whether that really was or just a perceived problem. I just don't know exactly how that stuff that's spewing out of exhaust does to redistribute itself in the environment. We don't create lead in this process, we redistribute it, and that's an important thing to recognize. And it may be we're simply better off with where we are. It doesn't make any difference that decision is made. And it was not a terribly difficult decision for us to get out of the business.
You've mentioned several times problems with the public arena and the media interpretations, and the idea that while to the outsider it appeared you may have been dragging your feet on the dyes, on the fluorocarbons, you in fact only took a few days because you waited for the science. Dow Chemical went through something similar when they found that the leaking mercury cells, that all the science indicated mercury underwater was fine, that there was no problem. But the moment the science showed that that was a problem, Dow took care of it and shut the plant down. So it's a matter of the science. You're working within the confines of the science that you know at the time. And you can't do much more than that.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's your responsibility. At least we always thought so. Mm-hmm. We can do anything the public wants us to do, but our responsibility is to point out the trade-offs and the costs, another way of saying the same thing, so that we really do understand what we're doing to ourselves. And industry can't always decide. When I say I don't know exactly what the lead problem was in the environment, I mean that. I don't know. I don't really know how kids get overdoses in a farm environment. I know how they get it in an urban environment when they're living in houses that have old paint on them. I know that very well. But Clearly, that the automotive decision was based on the perception that if you do this long enough, you really won't like the end result. And that may be right, but I didn't know that. I wasn't just sure of that in my own mind. And it was, it did make petroleum products burn very well. So we are constrained by the science, and sometimes that dialogue with the public is labored. It's very difficult.
Not too long ago, I saw advertising posted at the far end of the car on the commuter train I take in, and it said showed us some youngster sitting off in a corner. Said if your son's mind, if your child's mind isn't on history and mathematics, perhaps it's because it's on chemistry. And when I walked out, I looked at it, and it was an ad for a drug rehabilitation center.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a problem we have.
When I saw it, I said, gee, they can't be advertising chemistry. What could it be? And then...
there you are.
It's scary when those things happen. About this time also, the environmental situation arose in the 70s, and the increasing government regulations. How did you respond to those?
Well, I had that full belly of that, because I was with the represented upon in CMA, Chemical Manufacturers Association, during the 70s. And at the time that the toxic substances legislation came along, I was asked to sort of lead that charge for that group, with lots of help from my friends, but I sort of spearheaded it. And so I spent a year or so working with Congress, trying to craft a legislation that we could live with, made some kind of sense, and did in fact deliver some benefit along with the obvious added cost. That was a real eye-opener. My favorite expression to those who want to hear it is that, you know, before I went to Washington, I was apprehensive about how the place worked, and after I found out, I was terrified. That's still true. Because a lot of decisions are not made the way most scientists are used to approaching them. Whether you like the toxic substances bill or not, it was the best that we could do, and the industry has, in fact, learned to live with it. Some aspects of it are not very constructive, but there's no question that that all of us are concerned about materials that wind up in effluents, and we all need to be careful, to be good stewards of the earth. And the chemical industry has finally gotten out front on that, I think, and is doing a very good job. Point source emissions now are really not much of a problem, and that's a tremendous change from a couple of decades ago. And we'll get better. It's cost a lot. That's all right. That's a decision society has every right to make. Sometimes it has not delivered benefit proportion to cost, but nobody's perfect. And, you know, there are a lot of things that you can fuss about, but I think my view of where we're headed is fine, very comfortable. The process by which we found direction and by which we moved in those directions is really pretty crude, and in some places has been not productive. Dumps, you know, the landfill problem and the cleanups, that's been a disaster. And not because somebody doesn't want to do it, but because of the concept of joint and several liability and the unwillingness of people to spend $100 million cleaning up a dump when their contribution was 1%. You know, that's just, but they happen to be the only deep product pockets around, so they get the job. The Superfund approach conceptually might have been all right, but it was terribly flawed in implementation. And the chemical industry tried to straighten that out, but it's still waiting for a sensible resolution. Most of the environmental laws are somewhere between okay and very good. Again, some of the implementation has been crude and not cost effective, but I don't think anybody really wants to go back to crapping up our streams and rivers, and nobody likes dirty air, and that's right. We should not let those things happen. We still have a problem with doing it intelligently and cost effectively, and I suppose we always will.
At the time of Silent Spring, the chemical industry had, I think that's where it started to get its reputation, by stonewalling the initial, their initial response to
yes.
Rachel Carson. It was really a stonewalling response, which probably hurt them for a long time to come.
Yes.
What was DuPont's attitude at that time?
Well, I don't really remember much about that. We really came in a little later. We didn't have a lot of the products that were involved in the discussion. DDT was not one of ours, and I've forgotten what the others were. Partly because we did understand the chemistry of DDT and the biology of DDT, we probably weren't all that concerned, because the impact on people is de minimis. It's damn near put it on your cereal and it won't do you in. But birds are another matter. And it was very effective against malaria, mosquitoes, and things like that. So and I'm guessing now, because I don't really remember that we discussed it much, but probably the technical community within DuPont recognized that there could be a problem with indiscriminate use of pesticides, but that some of these were pretty darn useful, and we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So that probably was kind of where we were. Later on, when the cancer scare got to be the center of this public concern, we played a pretty important role in trying to articulate where we thought we were as an industry and as a society. You remember the horror of the month story, this chemical, now next chemical, we had the bischloromethyl ether. Is that right? Chloromethyl ether, one of those. And we had a half a dozen others, vinyl chloride, quite a few things. The perception was that this was the tip of the iceberg, and that when we really understood how bad chemicals were, we'd shut down the industry, or at least some people would be inclined to do that. And at that time, I was working on toxic substances, and I told a number of people in Congress, you know, you're exactly wrong. This is not the tip of the iceberg. This is the iceberg. We're at a time in history when we have learned most of what we're going to learn about toxicity of materials like this, and we know probably most, if not all, of the major bad actors right now, and we can deal with them. So be careful about coming up with rules and regulations that, you know, cause a mass confusion and generate enormous costs with no commensurate benefits. Now, they didn't believe me at the time, or at least a lot of them didn't, but since 1975, there have been very few new stories of that sort, almost none. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to come up with one. And so we went through that period when everybody was convinced that every chemical was going to do you in, that it was the primary cause of cancer, which it's not. They are not. And now I think we've settled down to the realization that we really do have a pretty good idea of what the risk is, and it's very small in terms of the whole of the total problem. Most cancers are caused by food and lifestyles and heredity and a few other things. The industrial input is certainly less than 5%, maybe less than 1 or 2. I'm not sure what the current view is, but you know, for a while it was 60%. Mm-hmm. And everybody could prove that. It was never true. So that was a very big concern, but that's largely been put to rest now, I think, and the people are a little bit more rational. Without question, the environment has been a major burden for industry in the last 20 years. Costs and distraction, whatever. But without question, much of it is important, useful, desirable, and in any case, it's the only acceptable way to go in our populist democracy. So I think we've coped reasonably well, and I think we'll get better at it with time, and eventually we'll be glad we did.
One thing that people at Dow used to say is that being in a small town, all the executives and everybody else lived right there by the plant. I mean, they weren't far away,
right.
And it was they used that as a testimony to their safety. And
well, I think we all have a little of that feeling, and I worked in atomic plants for a couple of years. I worked in sulfuring process with carbon disulfide and all the bad actors, hydrogen sulfide, all those bad actors. And I think those of us that have worked for responsible companies think that industry did it pretty well. Very, very well, in fact. Our people were safer at work than they were anyplace else. But people still get upset when you have a misadventure, an accident, and they really wonder whether we're as diligent as we ought to be. That's what keeps us hopping.
In May of 81, was the time when Ed Jefferson became chairman and CEO. According to one source, that came as no surprise. You became president and chief operating officer, and the source says there was no obvious signal that Heckert had inside track to the presidential office.
That's interesting. I don't know why there should have been any strong signal one way or the other. I'm a little surprised at the comment because at that point in time, I don't know what people would have had in mind. The problem that existed between Jeff and me had nothing to do with either Jeff or with me. It was that we were virtually the same age. He's 3 years older than I, and a very close personal friend, and a great guy, and a marvelous leader. So I never had any problem with his appointment, and I really would not have felt one way or the other about my not getting it. I have to tell you, I thought I would. So I can't really deal with that comment.
Okay. At that time, from what I've read, Jefferson was to focus on research, manufacturing, general management. You were going to be concerned with marketing, pricing, and that aspect of the company.
Those are things you say to make people believe you got a plan. We both worked on everything. But yeah, we divided up in a general way, just a matter of focus. But we were partners in every sense of the word.
A quote which I think comes from you at that time, DuPont's growth rate should be 50 to 100% faster than the overall economy.
That's what the chemical industry was doing in those days. You know, we were growing about twice the GNP. And the 50 was a concession to the fact that we were becoming large and mature. Most of us really hoped it would be 100%.
Now, the other change at this point was that you felt a lot of this could be done by acquisitions. A lot of this growth would happen by acquisitions.
Yeah, there were some areas that we thought we could do well in that we probably would approach by acquisition, at least initially, total acquisitions if nothing else. We certainly did one.
I was going to come to that, but before that, there was New England Nuclear, I think.
Yeah, there were a few. We were trying to figure out a way to make money out of healthcare, and
we did some very good things and did some excellent research, which I think in the future may eventually be recognized. But we never really made the business out of it that we'd hoped to. A sort of a sister business, agrochemicals, we did extremely well there. So those were two that we expected to, at that point in time, to expand pretty dramatically, and we did in one case, and the other we found another answer, which has turned out very well. But it's clear that the pot per se is not going to, near term at least, be a major player in healthcare, except through the venture.
Mm-hmm. There was some consideration given to pharmaceuticals. I was surprised to see that you had looked at Merrill Richardson before Dow did.
We looked at a lot of them. We were probably a little conservative on estimating values, and maybe a little cautious about some of the legal problems that appear to be associated with some products. Hard for me to look back and judge each of those. It may have been hard to say. I won't speculate. We'd had some experience with acquisitions that weren't altogether pleasant, and we had come to realize that that's hard work. When you acquire somebody, you better have a clear view of how they fit and how much pain is going to be associated with digestion and how good the end result will be, otherwise you better not touch it. So we were probably a little more conservative than we might have been, but I'm not terribly upset about the way it turned out. I think it's probably fine. I think we have a real contribution to make in agrochemicals. And not being directly involved with pharmaceuticals at this point in time doesn't give me great pain.
And that brings us to, in a very short period of time, from May of 81 when you and Jefferson took over to October of 81 with
it was shorter than that. That battle began in about 2 months.
Okay.
Behind the scenes.
Was Jefferson the driving force behind that?
Yeah, I think Jeff was probably, as he had made studies earlier on, very thoughtful analyses of how this might work to DuPont's advantage. And there was a time when we were having trouble getting raw materials, and this looked like a possible way to cure that problem. And by the time we got around to looking at Conoco, we really had concluded that we'd be able to buy on the market everything we needed, but that the oil business per se might be something that would be attractive to DuPont. So the Conoco acquisition was largely because Conoco was a good company, not so much because we were backfilling and assuring supply. Maybe talking too much.
No.
I haven't thought about these things for a long time. It's kind of fun.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing so now. You then moved into fabrics and finishes, 69 to 72. At this point, now you were general manager. You were no longer assistant general manager. Did you sense that you may have had some mentor or someone in the company working for your,
well,
in your case?
Not. My feeling was I had a great relationship with everybody around. I didn't really worry about one guy opposite the other. I did follow Norm Copeland a couple of steps up the road. He was a great blocker. I came to work for him as the director of supporting research, process research in film, from the plants, and he was then research director. He moved to assistant general manager. I moved to research director. Then he left that department, and I took his job again. So, in a sense, he was very helpful. But no, I never had a feeling that I had a white hat or anything like that. I just thought that I had lots of friends.
When you got to Fabrics and Finishes, that was the CorFam time.
Yes,
I recall. And
there sure was.
That was one of the more infamous instances that in DuPont's history. Were you involved in shutting the business down?
Very definitely, along with John Metzger. It's a long, sad story, and everybody who was a player for a number of years has his own version of why. Mine's pretty simple. When we looked at the business and our competition, part of which was synthetic and part of which was not, there were a couple of things which I didn't see a way around. Number one, the price of leather had nothing to do with in effect, the cost of making leather products. That was a byproduct of the meat industry, and you know, the leather was whatever they could get for it, so that price was pretty spongy. And I guess I concluded that whatever it took to move the product, that would be the price that they offered, and so there wasn't much support in that direction. And leather did some things very, very well in the shoe industry, and so it was always going to be a player, but a pretty tough one from the economic perspective. With respect to the synthetics, we all sort of looked down our nose at vinyl coated fabrics and urethane coated fabrics until they worked. And when the market began to accept them, and people really threw all man-made products in the generic and just didn't make much difference to them. It looked good, they'd buy it. And then we looked at our mill costs, not just the current ones, but our projections of the best we could do. I think the exact numbers were, we concluded we could probably make CorFam as we then defined it for 40 or 50 cents a square foot, and vinyls were selling for 30. Now, there's a message there for somebody who has his eyes open. And the urethane products really weren't that bad. You know, they're pretty good, and many applications. CorFam was a very good product, but a fairly expensive product. Among the sophisticated synthetics, it probably was the best. And that was borne out by the fact that the Poles looked at it very carefully and compared it with all the other offerings that were available at the time and decided they wanted the CorFam plant after we closed the business down. And they bought it lock, stock, and barrel, and as far as I know, it's still making product. So it wasn't that that we didn't make a good product or couldn't. Some of the earlier deficiencies we were well along to correcting, and we could see a day when we made a material that was every bit as comfortable as leather, wore better, kept its good appearance longer and easier to care for, and could sell for a price that could be recovered in the shoe business, which is a little bit different from saying it was competitive cost-wise with all the other things on the market. But it could have been a player. The problem was it could never be a really good earner. And a number of tens of millions of dollars would have had to be invested before it got to this comfortable level of performance. So, you know, it was when the air cleared, it was time to bag it. So Metzger he and I and others talked about it for a long period of time, and finally said, I really don't think we should continue this, and I agreed, and the committee agreed, so we cut it.
And shortly after that, you were made a vice president.
Yeah.
72.
73.
73. Okay.
well, vice president in 72, they changed the titles. I didn't join the X committee until 73. Mm-hmm. They just changed the titles of the department heads, as I recall.
Did that come as a surprise to you, or were you expecting it at that
time? No, by that time, you look around and see who the players are, and again, I never took the position that there were not people in the system that were every bit as good as I was, but I also felt that I was as good as they were, so it was just how I was going to fall.
And the executive committee, of course, is really was in, runs the company. I mean, that's where the decisions are made. How many members were on it when you joined it?
8 or 9, as I recall. It goes up and down, but it was about that. 10 at the most, 8 at the least, I guess.
Again, I'm quoting, he distinguished himself as a team player who always shared the credit.
Why not? That's just being honest.
Okay. I think the more interesting thing to me was the fact that very shortly thereafter you picked up the research reins.
Yeah, I had that for a while. At that point it was about half advisory and a little bit of direct managerial, but it was a fairly soft connection between the committee and the various units in the company. We did began to allocate assets at that point and encourage people to work in certain directions, but it was a while before it became a direct managerial responsibility.
Well, as I understand it, you very, very shortly there after 74, I guess, started indicating that the executive committee felt it necessary to reduce R&D within the company.
Yeah, our costs were pretty high. We've been through a decade. We launched a number of new ventures that didn't pan out particularly well. We really had demonstrated convincingly that the old formula, just identify a large market and figure out the way to supply it with a synthetic material, that alone was not enough to guarantee a successful business. And people would shoot me for using those crude words, but the new venture mania, which existed in the company in the 60s, had produced some businesses that were attractive, but it produced a large number of expensive failures. And we just concluded, we got to rein this thing in a little bit. The company had been managed pretty much as a sum of its parts up until the mid-60s or even early 70s in some respects. Now we had to manage it so that it wasn't all top-down, but at least the parts weren't going to spend more of the resources than we had. It was going to be a plan that made sense for DuPont as a whole, as well as one that made sense for the individual departments. So it was no longer just managing the company as the sum of its parts. It was the DuPont company and these different departments and interests. Each year, we developed a business plan that made sense from the top down as well as the bottom up.
Having started out in your career out in research and in good basic science and basic chemistry, how did you feel about having to go to these people and say it's time that we make some serious changes here?
I didn't like it at all, but I didn't think it was wrong. I thought it was right. Well, the facts pretty much spoke for themselves. The record is what it was, and fact is we were in a situation where we were spending more for R&D than we could justify based on the results that we were getting from it. And that wasn't necessarily all research's fault, but here's a function that had simply gotten out of proportion with the rest of the business. And my message always was, hey fellas, if you want to spend more on research, there is one formula that will work every time. Let's make more money. And until we can do that, there isn't going to be more money for R&D. We simply have to live within our means until we can demonstrate the ability to bring on new things that will be very, very profitable and generate more discretionary cash. So it isn't rocket science, you know, it just we had to do some resizing, make everything fit together.
Well, the nylon, Teflon doesn't come along all that often.
Well, they don't. In fact, the polymer science has been a fascinating thing to watch. It's gone through several phases. In the 40s, 50s, well, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, we had these whole new families of important materials, and then there was a period of adapting them to all the use opportunities that existed, and then there was the period of combining them, composites and everything else, and so it's been reworked two or three times and still enormously important, and I suspect, you know, there's a lot of future to it too, but it's changing. Finding a new simple combination of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen that's going to turn into a huge product is very difficult. One of the examples I used to use when I was talking about DuPont's dilemma with new businesses, I said, when nylon began, I guess at that time it would have been, let's see, this was about 1980 when I was making this comment, 40 years ago. The company was a billion or $2 billion company, and nylon was a fledgling product. Today, nylon is a $2 billion business. So our challenge today with the pond at $40 billion is to come along with a new product that in 40 years will be $40 billion. Now, you tell me what that is. You know, that's the arithmetic of this rate of growth. And the simple truth is those products are not there. At least, I don't think they are. They're very hard to find. Although there'll be new industries that'll be huge, and we're seeing some of that, but not necessarily based on polymers or even chemistry. It's not solely. So it's a dilemma. When you get older and bigger, and your product lines are inevitably a bit more mature, you have to change a little bit of how you behave, and it's not just what's happened to you, it's what's happened to the rest of the world. You know, in 1950, DuPont was unique in its ability to mount a major new venture. It had the technical ability, it had the business disciplines, it had the manufacturing capability, it had the engineering capability. There weren't many people like that in the world. By 1970, there was one, as I used to say, on every corner of every large city. Now, that's not quite right, but what I was trying to do was get people's attention on how much the outside world has changed, and therefore how unlikely it was that research per se was going to make us hugely successful. We had to do a lot of other things, and we had to recognize that the competitive picture had changed dramatically.
What kind of response did you get to this program?
I'd say generally favorable. In many respects, very favorable. One of my messages was, hey, don't look for the committee to save you. You know, you're the guys that make the decisions day by day that really build this company, that change it. You're the agents of change. If you don't like what's going on around you, don't just look in the mirror every day. Don't look at the committee. It can't do everything for you. It's just not possible. And I made several speeches in which I said, if I look back at my career, I've made a lot of mistakes, but the mistakes that really bother me are the errors of omission, not commission. There were a lot of things that I could see and I should have done and I didn't do. And those are the ones that cause you not to sleep as well as you might otherwise. So there was a message for middle and upper management and everything I said that was very positive, that really said to these people, you're the ones with the clout. You're the ones that can make things happen. And none of us like our business performance over the last couple of decades. We all want to do better, and we can. But it's going to take input from every one of you. You're going to have to help us redefine DuPont and do those things that make it again, what we think it should be in relation to our competitors. So I think we've been through that process, and no one of us did it all, or even most of it, but it's been a continuum since the late 60s, and Lord has certainly had his share of the problem, and he's handled it very courageously, and a very difficult challenge, but the results speak for themselves, and we are better.
Do you think that, well, go back to the time you joined the research group at DuPont, there was an attitude, maybe even a luxury of, we can do this great basic research. And DuPont had a long history of that, the papers and the literature and everything, that there's good solid chemistry going on. And maybe we'll get something good out of it, but was this really a luxury that you could no longer afford?
Well, I'm very reluctant to say that we can't afford it, that we shouldn't do some of it, but certainly it has to be done in proportion to its potential reward. And the fact is, the reward from that kind of goalless research is thin. We've had these arguments, not just in DuPont, but throughout the world and industry, whether research ought to be need-oriented or basic research with materials, and that the obvious uses will just fall out of that. Well, that's kind of a dumb argument. The fact is, it's an iterative process. Anything you can learn that's new and different and useful about the basic behavior of matter is fine. But it's not necessarily terribly rewarding just to start down that road. Certainly, anything that you can do to meet a very important need of the world in a cost-effective way is going to be very rewarding. So you can't get the need end out of it. You can't get the understanding of basic principles and behavior of matter and whatnot out of it. It's an iterative process. You got to do both. But we concluded, at least in the 70s and the 80s, we had to do a little bit less of this directionless research and a little bit more aimed at making our products better, our processes better. And where we could see new products, sure, go for it. But be realistic about what competitors are doing and what the competitive response will be if you're going to try and knock somebody else off. Nobody gives up easily.
Well, I think the United States is probably in a unique position after World War II in terms of the strength of its chemical industry as opposed to the rest of the world.
Europe was in shambles. Our plants were together. We had going what they hoped to rebuild. The other side of that is, 20 years later, they were working with new plants, and ours were aging, and they took advantage of all the new technology that came along. So, there was quite a dramatic change in 20 years.
You had an ad hoc committee at that time, which I believe consisted of several of the research directors, if not all of them.
Yes.
And then you reported to the executive committee, and there were several recommendations. One was to cut the R&D expense by 4% per year, something like that. The central research was to give up one half of its budget from projects supported by the industrial departments.
The thought there was to try to impose a discipline on central research of working on things that were important to existing businesses. And this was just kind of an arbitrary and not very sophisticated push to get them to do more work that the departments were enthusiastic about and could see some commercial value from. 50%, who knows what the right number is, but that's about where we thought we needed to get. And it was kind of a negotiated goal that everybody could live with, and I think it was very helpful. The 4% per year, I've never been terribly happy with the excesses that businesses had to go through in order to get its house in order. Sometimes they're just flat necessary. There's nothing else you can do. But I always been upset by recruiting years when we hired 2,000, and then the next year when we hired nobody or 100 or something like that. I said, you know, what kind of a message is that to send to the universities? That's terrible. Now, we're going to be in business forever, we hope. We know we're going to have ups and downs. Why do we ever hire 2,000? And why do we ever hire just 50? You know, why don't we be good enough managers so that we can, you know, well, we can't avoid the peace in the valleys, but for heaven's sakes, let's smooth them out. Well, we eventually got some discipline in hiring, and we did get better. But to make a quick adjustment in an R&D program has incredibly negative morale implications and results, and I just have an angry stomach for that. With attrition, you can, as long as you're not bleeding to death, you can cure almost any problem. And I didn't think we were in bad enough shape so that we needed to do any more than a few percent per year, and normally that is done fairly easily.
Somewhere, I believe, Cairns came to you and said that the DuPont's research image had reached a low ebb in the universities.
Yeah, we got a lot of concern about that. And part of it was this cycling of recruiting. Part of it was the perception outside that we were really giving up on R&D, which was never true. We tried to deal with those impressions honestly and effectively, and I don't know how well we did, but I think eventually the universities recognized that we had no choice but to make some adjustments. And yes, we still love research, and we're going to do it, but it had to be the right size and generally pointed at the right goals. Otherwise, we couldn't afford it.
Well, certainly your alma mater, Illinois, and DuPont had a long-standing connection.
Wonderful.
Carl Marble as consultant to students.
An amazing man and a great friend.
Did you, just as an aside, did you ever pick up his love for birds along the way?
Well, he would not be very happy with what I do with birds. I think quail are marvelous eating. But yeah, I love nature very, very much. Even though I hunt and I fish, I am an ardent conservationist, belong to the Nature Conservancy Board and all the rest, but I don't do so much looking at them as he did.
I just talked to someone, I'm not sure if it was Jim Idle or not, I think it was Jim Idle, who said that Marble told him if he ever had it to do over, he'd have been an ornithologist.
Marble's that kind of person. He could do anything he wanted to, like Crawford Greenwald. Mm-hmm. Crawford was just incredible with the spectrum of interests that he had and his ability to do well in anything he chose to deal with. Marble, the same kind of person.
By 1977, you were still assuring, as this program of change in R&D was going on, you were still assuring the board of directors, who evidently were getting nervous about things as well, that while the R&D was in a period of transition, you were still spending more than competitors in research, and that research was still critical to the company's future.
The board was, you know, a little uncomfortable about some of the things that they were hearing on the outside. It's very hard to compare research programs because people don't use the same words to describe the same kinds of research. And our international people lump things somewhat differently. But as best we could measure it, we were doing about as much as anybody else, and maybe more. And there certainly was not a large gap. All of those discussions were less than truly scientific. You know, first place, nobody quite knew how to make the comparison. In the second place, whether we were doing the right amount has far more to do with what we were getting out of it than it does what anybody else does. So, you know, we tried to be comforting because we really thought the pond was not going to fall behind. And the tuning up we were doing, in fact, might very well make us more productive and in the future justify even more. But there was a lot of nervousness, and those were worries just to give people a little comfort, which, you know, their discomfort was genuine, and we needed to deal with it. But I just never really worried that much about the intercompany comparisons.
Organic chemicals department suffered considerably at this time for a number of reasons. They had three major businesses, all of which ran into problems, beginning with dyes. I'm not sure when DuPont finally got out of dyes. Was that during your time?
Must have been around the mid-70s, somewhere in there.
And then, of course, CFCs and TEL, which were at one time three big players in the company.
That's right.
This sort of fits in with...
consideration, but nobody really thought that was an essential thing for DuPont to do at that point in time. But Conoco looked good to us, and our projections of what was going to happen to crude prices, and which weren't true, and how it might, the synergy might work. I'd say most of that turned out as we saw it. The really good news in the Conoco acquisition was that the Conoco people were a very good fit with DuPont. But the business was not one that we didn't understand. We didn't pretend to know where to look for oil or how the market would behave in the future, but we did know it was an important business. We found out that we'd gotten in bed with very good people. And we did think it would be countercyclical, which it has turned out to be. When the oil company has a good year, the chemicals don't necessarily. So we've smoothed out the earnings curve very nicely, and it's just been a very successful marriage. And I think if you talk with the Conoco people, you get pretty much the same story. If DuPont had not acquired Conoco, I do not think Conoco would have lasted very long as a freestanding company. And if an oil company had picked them up, obviously their ranks would have been thinned quite a bit. But that's a different kind of marriage.
Yes. Did you have much selling to do with the executive committee?
The committee was came together very nicely at the end of the day. There were some concerns in the committee whether we really wanted to do this, and some conviction that we didn't have to. And I think both were valid positions. But at the end of the day, Jeff made it very clear, look, gang, whether you're going to unite on this thing and do it as a happy family, or we're not going to do it. And put that way, the committee felt, well, on balance, we ought to go ahead. And it wasn't a hard sell, particularly, but when you do something on that scale, everybody better be reasonably comfortable with it. Otherwise, you better not do it. And I think we reached that level of comfort fairly easily.
Come back to R&D at all. What was R&D's perception of this? How did they react to it?
They probably thought we'd lost our minds, at least some of them, but I think when they got a chance to think about it, there was no great concern. Nobody perceived this as a threat. At least they shouldn't have. Conoco's R&D turned out to be pretty good. Obviously different, but they had some capabilities which we took advantage of, some good summer works facilities and things like that, and there really was quite a bit of synergy between the two companies that was uncovered as we lived together, and a lot of trading of product back and forth, so it turned out very well.
Were there other possibilities considered before Conoco? I mean, when you started
other
looking at this?
Other kinds of ventures. We started to build a a refinery, and I had a project on the table, which the finance committee turned down. That would have been late 60s, early 70s. We had various long-term contract arrangements with suppliers. We kept poking at it because we were concerned about the cost of raw materials and the availability of raw materials, and concerned that the tremendous cash flow generated by businesses like that could lead to some people that were very well financed and competitors in chemicals. So, you know, a little bit of a, maybe I have better have one foot in this boat just in case it turns out to be the way to get into certain things we want to do. So there were a lot of reasons like that, and we had worried over the issue for about 10 years, so we were not approaching it cold.
Okay.
In 86, then, Jefferson retired, and you finally did. I think I read a quote from Shapiro who said if he had had his way, he would have liked to have seen you in that position earlier. Then.
I didn't hear that. Yeah, I know, but that doesn't belong in this discussion.
Okay. Around that time, I'm quoting again, his passion is marketing and he is revamping a company that has always emphasized R&D. Wall Streeters say his strategy has helped make DuPont healthier than it has been in years.
Well, that's very generous, but a lot of people worked on that. And that was just a natural evolution of the company that I and my predecessors have been trying to change for 20 years. I go back to the word partnership. I never worked with a chairman that I didn't feel was my partner. That starts with McCoy and Shapiro and Jefferson, certainly, and I think Woolard would say the same thing. It's a continuum. And so, I had the best part of the ride, I have to tell you, because those 3 years were pretty good. But that, not because I was that much different from anybody else, but because that's where we were in this evolution. Woolard, on the other hand, caught the period when the economy went sour and when downsizing and cost cutting were the name of the game. And so you take the oars when they're given to you, and you row the waters that you that you have. So I think if you talk with any one of us, as you have and will, you discover that each of us has enormous respect for the contributions of others along the way, and we're a little reluctant to take credit for much of anything except not letting it get out of control. But we all felt good about those years because we had been working in that direction for a long, long time. And a lot of the things that each of us individually and collectively had stressed were beginning to pay off.
Mm-hmm. The message you sent to employees, and we've mentioned this earlier, is that the breakthrough products once sold themselves, but now marketing is crucial because of the competition is stronger.
That's very true.
And the quote, your quote was, we have to learn to win without all the aces.
Yeah, that's very true. Exactly what I said.
How did people respond to that?
Well, marketing people loved it. Technical people might have been slightly bruised, but I think they understood where we were. Manufacturing, likewise. No, that was not a problem. That really worked into the concept that I've been stressing with all our senior managers. You know, you fellas can make the difference. It's not going to be just product or just anything else. It's how we run this business, and you're the guys that make the calls. You can have an enormous impact on what happens.
You also attacked the inward focus of, at management retreats.
Consistently. And appropriately, in my view. Yeah, you fall in love with what you're doing internally. You forget that the customer only buys product. He wants to pay for product and nothing else. He doesn't want to pay for a large this or a large that that has no value to him. He wants to pay for value and for goods received or services received. And people who work in large organizations are in grave danger of falling in love with what they do, and expanding their part of the enterprise becomes the number one goal, whereas that may or may not be good for the business. So you really have to look outside and ask, does the customer give a damn about what I do? And if he doesn't, should I have this job? I even told our legal people, if you can't see some reason why you're useful to the customer, then you've got a problem. Every one of these divisions, in fact, does in one way or another serve the customer. But the question of how much the customer wants to buy of that is one we have to constantly keep in front of us. And so that really was a thrust, you know. Just remember, if the value isn't there, in fact, or at least perceived, we have a problem.
Another quote: in just over a year, Heckert has bought $1 billion worth of new businesses and peeled away layers of management to get executives closer to their customers.
That was, had been going on for quite some time. Those businesses, some were okay, some weren't. At least they weren't total winners.
Did you have a strategy and what you were looking for?
Most of the acquisitions we made, other than Conoco, were generated at departmental level. The interest in them was generated at departmental level, usually with prior discussion with the executive committee on, you know, logical ways to expand the business. So, I've forgotten exactly which. I think we had three in that period of time. And they were largely departmental initiatives supported in principle by the committee.
Okay. Something we also just talked about, but another quote: management by committee can lead to hardening of the corporate arteries.
Yeah.
And I think this was the time when the relationship of the members of the executive committee changed. It was less advisory, more direct.
That's correct.
And was that your doing?
Well, it started under Jeff. But it was a continuum again. We had long discussions about what the committee really ought to be. I had some problem with that. My problem was not that the committee members couldn't run the businesses, but I worried about whether or not we could maintain what I had worked so hard, along with Jeff and others, to build in the way of committee relationships. When nobody has any special stake in any of the departments, then it's easy for us to come together as a managing group because we're not protecting turf. There are no turf issues between us. I question whether, if we went to a straight line management arrangement, whether we would maintain this rather extraordinary climate that had developed over about two or three decades, which the pot didn't always have. But we had learned to disagree without being disagreeable, and we respected one another, and we really were clicking about that time as a management team at the committee level. I thought we disciplined the committee, and and made certain changes in relationships with the rest of the company, so that the committee system had finally gotten close to perfection, or at least it was much better than it had been in a long time. And so here we were deciding to change now that we finally learned how to do it. And that bothered me a little bit, but I've not, as I've lived with the change, it has not turned out to be a problem. But it is important. And you see this again and again as you look at what happens with some companies. Well, the top three or four people don't get along very well. That can lead to a real disaster. It's an enormous distraction. And I think it's an impediment to making good decisions. And so I wanted to preserve that with no question in my mind that the members of the committee would be very good at running the individual pieces of the company. I had no problem with that concept at all, but I did want to preserve the ambiance that we had worked so hard to create. And I think that was largely done. That was my only concern about the change.
At one point, automotive products, you talked about getting closer to the customers, the automotive products group moved to Detroit, and actually led to new developments because they were in closer contact with...
Excellent to see.
Which brought them almost back neck and neck with GE. I don't know where they are today. This is a few years ago, but...
I'd say we've evened it up a bit. I really don't know either. I'm not close to the numbers anymore, but we're a player, for sure.
Is this moving of groups out of this area to being closer to their customer, like the automotive group, was that your decision?
No, I don't recall whose decision it was, but it was a kind of thing that departments were talking about as a result of this focus on customers and markets. And we had a fairly large presence out there. We recognized that untenable aspects of the old arrangement was we had DuPont people out there calling on GM that didn't know one another, and sometimes buying for the same piece of the business, and that just got to be a ridiculously inefficient way to do it. And we began putting special laboratories out there, and finally concluded that the whole business ought to go out there. So we had a finishes development, color development, paint development laboratory out there, and we had a large plastics contingent. And finally we said, why in the hell do we have all those people out there and not the boss? And we stick him out there where he belongs and see if we can't get a little better coordination. And as a consequence, our service to automotive improved very dramatically. I don't remember who first said the words, but it had been taking place piecemeal for a number of years, and everybody knew that this was right. That's one of the problems with the committee system. Nobody can remember who said it first. And nobody cares.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and I'm not familiar with DuPont's role in global ventures and when that occurred.
Well, we had invested in North and South America 60 or 70 years ago. I've forgotten how old those units are now, but we've been outside the U.S., Canada and Mexico and Argentina, Venezuela for a long, long time. A little bit of activity in Europe and virtually nothing in the Far East. About 1960, we began to realize that that the Pacific Rim is going to be very important, and I think in the next several years we established five or six joint ventures in Japan, which is the only thing that was available to us at that point, and began pushing hard in Europe, not just with marketing but with manufacturing facilities and all the other service aspects of the business, so that
I'd say DuPont became a, quote, international company somewhere around the beginning of the 60s. It was clear then that Europe was going to be a very big and important economic area, and the Pacific Rim also, and so it was time to get going.
During your term, what were you, what was happening in the international area during your term?
Well, we were growing, probably probably a little faster in the Pacific than we were in Europe, but we were growing in all these different areas, and I was spending a lot of time on international aspects of the business. We were predicting that by the middle of this decade or shortly thereafter that more than half of our business would be outside the U.S. Don't hold me exactly to those that frame and that number, but it's roughly that, I think. And certainly that by the turn of the century we'd have a bigger stake outside than inside the U.S. And that's continued. So that's another one of those things that nobody in recent generations started, but we've all worked hard on, and Lloyd's working very hard on it today, with good results and very good reasons.
Another aspect was your willingness to go outside for talent, outside the company for talent. For example, somebody from IBM was hired. He had designed a process of creating ceramic circuits, and you wanted to get into that technology and actually hired somebody away from IBM. Were there other examples of that, and how was that received?
Well, there were a few in pharmaceuticals and some new areas of R&D related to life sciences. Primarily, and some, I guess, in the computer area. We had concluded that, you know, it's fine to grow your own management when that's possible, but if that becomes a limitation on human resources, that's dumb. So, somewhere along the sure, this doesn't go way back, I just don't know because I wasn't there, but ever since I've been on the committee, we've been willing to go outside, and I would say we became more and more impressed with the importance of going outside if you're getting into some area that you don't know very well, and you're really, the most dangerous thing you can do is acquire a business that you don't really understand, serving a market that you don't really understand. That's really a dangerous step. So you've got to bring people in that know the story.
Well, again, I'm quoting, and this is 1986, but Heckert may not be able to bring in enough new blood to make a difference.
Well, that's a...
an analyst viewpoint.
Yeah, I never really handled the analyst very well in my view, because the analyst didn't really recognize what my agenda was, and my agenda wasn't very saleable. We'd been through a period of enormous change, and it was continuing. And I knew I had 3 years and no more. And my view of life was, let's give DuPont a breather. Let's do everything that we're doing now that can make the business better. But let's not thrash around and try to reinvent the company in a three-year period. I was much more concerned with making sure that Woolard got off to a fast start and that he had every opportunity to, you know, test himself before he took over, because he was clearly the heir apparent. And I didn't do what a lot of people who have the prospect of serving 5 or 10 years do, that is reinvent the company in my own image and set out to make it happen. In the first place, I've been part of the management team for 13 years already, and I identified myself completely with where DuPont was and where DuPont was going. I'd had 13 years to influence the process.
And if I wasn't happy with it, there must have been something wrong with me. So why should I, on the beginning of my term, come out with a bunch of new pronouncements about what the pot was and where it ought to go? I didn't feel that. I thought we were headed in a very good direction. And in any case, I wasn't going to be around long enough to make any huge difference. Now, you know, you can evaluate that attitude any way you choose. I think it was realistic. And in any case, I really was not dissatisfied with where we were or where we were headed, and I was very anxious to see us continue some of the changes that were underway without interruption, without distraction. And we had 3 very good years. So in my view, that was just the right approach. Willard had every opportunity to think long and hard about what he wanted to do, and so he came to the chair with plenty of preparation and really with a head start on doing what he wanted to do, which is just the way it should have been. So I think both transitions were smooth. Jeff, to me, was easy, and for me, Willard was smooth and positive, and no rancor, no philosophical difficulties.
Which is very important for a company that's undergoing transition to have that.
I think so. I never, apologize at all for my view of life, but the analysts don't think that's very impressive. Christ, here's a guy who's new in the chair and he doesn't want to turn the company upside down. What's the matter with him? Might be just that he has good sense.
I hadn't realized, though, that I think it's an interesting point that the experience you have on the executive committee for all those years really puts you in a different position when you take over, as opposed to somebody who all of a sudden is
absolutely
in that position.
And particularly the way we ran it. I was a bona fide player from 1973 until 1986, and certainly from then until 1989. So I had 16 years in that council, which is enough for anybody. And I didn't feel put upon because I only had 3 at the top. That's silly. I was as close as I needed to be for a long, long time.
I've come to the end of my list of notes, and the agenda that I had sent you, we've covered a good part of it. I just wanted to touch base on a few other things here. Scientific innovation, what does it mean to you as exemplified from your experience?
Well, I'm afraid that I am on the pragmatic side of that one. I love exploratory research in new areas. You mentioned tetracyanoethylene earlier. Started out to be a promising new monomer, but as soon as we learned that it didn't make a polymer, we still had a huge amount of fun with it. So I understand the joy of exploring this earth and its yet to be discovered secrets. But innovation to me is inevitably linked to society and to new products and or new services that are going to make or society better or change the way in which we go about conducting our affairs. It has to be useful. It has to be commercially important. Or it's just a curiosity. That doesn't make it unimportant, because curiosity is, good fiction is important, but lots of things that are important in life. But the innovation that I am really concerned about is the innovation that does change the way in which we conduct our affairs physically. And that's new products and new processes and whole new sciences and whole new markets, but always linked to something that somebody in the street gets some benefit from.
And how you make people innovative is a very interesting question.
That was my next one.
To me, the links between the different branches of the business are extremely important in this process. It is an iterative process. It can't be anything else. And in order for young people to be truly creative, they have to have some goals, they have to have some direction of some kind. And in a business, it ought to have a pretty strong market base and orientation. But they don't have to be bathed in all the problems of the market. They don't have to understand everything about the existing market. They just have to have some ideas, some concepts, some dreams about how something they might do in a particular area might be useful. So I grew up being hammered with the words need-oriented R&D, and I understand that very well. I also grew up in an environment where people were given considerable flexibility to think how some new branch of science might possibly be useful without knowing exactly how. And I appreciate that, and I support it, and I think a certain amount of that is fine. In the university, it's great. In an important, large research facility like ours, it has a place. But it isn't 90% of the work. It's more like 10 or 5 or whatever. And so innovation has to do with product and process and new markets, new concepts, new branches of science that clearly are going to change the way the world works.
We've talked about teamwork, we talked about changes in management agendas. Let's look at the chemical industry in a more general sense. What would you say have been the major changes in the industry during your career?
Well, without question, globalization and competition. And of course, those are not separate issues. But what I told you earlier, the difference between DuPont in 1950 and DuPont in 1970 was at least as much outside the company as inside the company. We simply, in that period of time, developed enormously competent competitors in all parts of the world that were fully up to date in technology and were well capitalized and were interested in serving world markets and were not just competitors in their countries, but throughout the world. So that's a huge change. The recognition that markets were going to be open and that businesses, they were going to be large and important and a discipline like chemistry would have to be global, that was a huge change. They're woven together, but those are the things that really transformed us. Environmental concerns are are there, but they really relate to how we do our business, not what the business is and what the new challenges and opportunities are, well, to some extent, but it's a little bit of a different category. The globalization and the emergence of competition on a scale that you could not have imagined in 1950, I think, are the things that really have transformed this industry. And we do it very well. You know, the chemical industry is a net exporter, partly because of the good fortune of having good resources and very good universities, very good people to work with. We're fully competitive. The only arena in which we're not competitive is one where we have a competitor who has one hand in the federal till. And that's hard. We still haven't quite learned how to cope with that.
I guess the airline industry has had so
boy. In spades. In spades.
What do you think is important in terms of chemical innovation? We talked about how you changed R&D within DuPont, but in general, what's important for new ideas to come down
well,
in the future?
This, more than anything else with the existing businesses, is the right kind of dialogue between marketing and manufacturing and R&D. And it takes lots of different forms. When research people really know what the problems are in the plant and they're really convinced that marketing cares about it, lots of good things happen. When they're not sure that anybody gives a damn, nothing happens. And so it's, to me, there's nothing more important than the right kind of communication within the company. And I would submit that some exposure outside the company is pretty good for innovators. And certainly some focus on what's going on in major markets is important to them and what the competition is doing. Nothing quite as sobering as a hands-on experience with a competitor's product that's a little better than yours. That does focus the mind.
Do you think that in the earlier days that the R&D people were pretty sheltered from the outside world, or were they always?
Well, in some places, yeah, in some places not. Some departments were very good at going out and finding out what the problems were in the marketplace. Some were kind of defensive, or at least not very offensive. Generalizations are just that, they're not really very helpful. But I'd say we did go through a period between about 1950 and 1970 when we really believed that we could specify the agenda for the chemical industry and for the markets we serve. It would be our new products that were really important, and all we had to do was use the right venture techniques, make a good analysis of the market and turn our technical people loose on the obvious options and just get in there and hit it with a brand new business. Well, that's great, except that you're not operating in a vacuum. And the difference between the environment that existed in 1950 and 1970 was really overwhelming, and we just had to stop being internally focused, or at least waited on that side. At no time did DuPont ignore the markets and the rest of the world, but there was a period when we did have a large preoccupation with what went on within the company, and we're not quite as sensitive as we should have been to what was going on outside. Pure and simple.
One last minor question that I have, and that is, when you won the SCI medal, what meaning did that have?
Well,
to you?
In some respects, not much, because those things happen to people that are in the right place. But in many respects, very special, because my view of DuPont and the chemical industry is that those two entities are a collection of very honorable and very bright and very nice people. People that you may compete with tooth and nail, but you respect and you like when you get to know them. So maybe it's an old-fashioned view of life, but I really liked the business I was in, and I liked the competitors I had and the markets we served. And so having your friends say nice things about you is always very agreeable. But it was in that context, I've often thought about trying to honor somebody, what that really means. You don't ever heap honor on them. They've earned the honor. The rest of the world usually knows that they're unusual contributors or have been unusually fortunate or whatever. So your recognition is really kind of after the fact and perhaps not very important. And so awards per se, they are what they are, and I don't much get excited one way or the other. But to have your friends appreciate that you're a player is nice. And I have to tell you, it was pleasant for me. Don't think it made me better, don't think it made me worse.
Is there anything else that I haven't covered that you'd like to add at this point?
I think I've had diarrhea of the mouth for 2 or 3 hours, so I'm the one that probably overdid it.
No, not at all.
But I think this is certainly a pretty good crash course in what's happened in the last 30 or 40 years. I still think it's a very honorable profession and a wonderful industry, and I hope our society will eventually learn how important we are and be a little more appreciative. They should. Now, we haven't talked much about the academic relationship, and I won't get into another tirade, but I want to tell you how important I think our superior colleges and universities have been to this industry, and how impressed I am every time I go back. You know, the kids are wonderful, the professors are great. Their understanding of what's going on around the world is, in many respects, as good or better than mine, and I think we are blessed with an incredible amount of support from that direction. And we damn well better take care of those institutions. That doesn't mean they don't have to change too, because they've got cost problems of their own, but we got to avoid throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They're really tremendously important.
Well, on that note, I'll thank you very much for spending the morning with me. It's been very enjoyable.